Hello and welcome back to the Quantum Divide. This is episode 22, actually, which is pretty exciting. Thanks again for tuning in. I'm sure you've missed me since last week. I want to tell you about my guest this week. So I've got Poulad Imani, who is joining us from the US. He is the CEO of Icarus Quantum, which is a spin-out from NIST, National Institute of Standards and Technology, and University of Colorado. So he has a PhD from Purdue University in Electrical and Computer Engineering, where he then went to work. And here we are with his company, Icarus. So Icarus is a spin-out of the Quantum Nanophotonics Group at NIST. Icarus is developing on-demand, single and entangled photon generators for scalable quantum networking applications. So really what we're talking about here is quantum dots, but specifically a family of quantum dots based on the gallium arsenide semiconductor platform. Icarus have some interesting collaborations with the US public sector, so we're going to explore that and dive into the deep side of the technology as well, as I always like to do. Okay, welcome, Poulad. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
Yeah, great. Let's start like I always do with a little bit of an intro. So I'm keen to know some of your background, but also your path into quantum would be super interesting. If it's just through academia or if there's any quirks in the path that you took.
Yeah, so I did an undergrad in electrical engineering and also went on to do a PhD in the same electrical engineering, focused on optics. So for my undergrad, I did that back in Iran. I'm Iranian. I grew up in Iran. And after undergrad, I joined Purdue University to work on optics, but with one of the big names in frequency combs and pulse shaping. So in ultra-fast optics. And yeah, this, my advisor's name was Professor Andrew Weiner, who was the inventor of pulse shaping. And coincidentally, at the time that I joined the group, he got this project about, can you actually shape quantum light? Can you do pulse shaping on single photons? And it was right at the same time that I joined the group that he got this project. And he was very open about, what project do you want to work on? I was like, this looks amazing. And so that's how I entered quantum. And so through quantum optics, and that was 10 years ago. And yeah, fast forward, I'm still doing quantum optics with a bit of a more scalable approach now, but the gist of it is the same.
And the rest is history, as they say.
Yeah.
So you've been at NIST, are you still at NIST, is that right?
I'm still at NIST, yes. After my PhD, I joined NIST as a postdoc 4 years ago, and to the Quantum Nanophotonics Group. Still working with quantum light, but with a more scalable platform. So during my PhD, I was working with microresonators and ways to generate quantum light, let's say probabilistically. So this was generating entanglement with a process that you just don't know when it happens. It's very inefficient, but it gives you, yeah, very cool and high quality quantum light and entanglement. I didn't think that this was the way to the future. So when I moved to NIST it was a project to work on quantum dots and to figure out how to actually connect different pieces of quantum networks to each other through quantum transduction. The project that I was working on was going from a superconducting qubit, convert the quantum information from there to surface acoustic waves, so to vibrations on the surface. So the same way that you can quantify light into photons, you can quantify sound into phonons, and which...
I'm smiling.
Previous episode. Yeah. Yeah, that I was listening to from QFox. Yeah, which, Rob really explained that beautifully. But so, yeah, going from a superconducting qubit, phonons, in our case, we had another intermediate quantum system, which is a quantum dot, and then the quantum dot would generate your photons for you. And so you would go all the way from a microwave photon to an optical photon, and you can do long-range quantum networking of quantum computers that way. And so, that was the project that I was working on at NIST. And a couple of years into it, we realized the quality of the quantum dots that we're making are very unique. And there is actually a demand on the industry side for them. And the quantum networking effort is taking off everywhere. We started Icarus Quantum to focus on making quantum light using our quantum dots.
Excellent. I'm going to ask you about some of the details around quantum dots in a moment. But first of all, NIST. So, National Institute of Standards and Technology. Not being an American, I guess, I don't fully understand how all the different institutes are connected. But I understood that NIST really was there to develop standards. Of course, everybody knows them for the post-quantum cryptography standards. But it sounds like you studied there, or you studied with them. Is there a university as part of the organization, or is it a sponsorship thing?
So definitely there is. So here we're based in Boulder. So we're NIST Boulder. NIST has maybe three campuses, but two giant campuses, one in Gaithersburg in Maryland, and the other one, which is us, it's in Boulder, Colorado. And it has a very close relationship to University of Colorado, Boulder. There is actually an entity that is jointly owned by NIST and the university. So the university is called CU Boulder, not to be mistaken with the University of California. So they flipped CNU, so it's called CU Boulder. But there's this entity jointly owned by CU and NIST called JILA. And so there are professors there are researchers there, and there's really this amazing synergy between the two entities. And actually, when I was hired by NIST, because I was not a citizen, I was technically hired by the university, even though I was just working at NIST, but I was a NIST contractor, but a CU employee.
Got it. Okay, so JILA is the astrophysics and optics physical science type center, is it? Is that right? Sounds a bit like a kind of industry meets academia, but specifically for public sector, do you say?
Yes, it is kind of looking at NIST and comparing it with the university, that there are much bigger projects that you can work on. And there is, because people are not, there's not this large turnaround of people at a university. If you're a PhD student, then you eventually graduate. Here at NIST, you can work on bigger projects, and we're trying to make these as collaborative as possible to the university as well. And we do, in our group at NIST, we do have graduate students who are, again, as a result of this relationship between the university and NIST. But they work at NIST facilities, and it's amazing to actually be exposed to all these, like the clean room facilities and the labs here as a graduate student.
Thank you for explaining that to the daft Englishman. Just trying to piece it together. Hey, let's come on to your company and also Elevate Quantum, which is how I found you, or you found me, I should say. Tell me a bit about your company, how it's, obviously it's a spin-off from the university. You're somehow involved with NIST through funding.
Yeah.
Give us a view of the overall scope and scale of it at the moment and what your plan is. That would be good to know as well.
Yeah. So we started Icarus Quantum 2 years ago, just to reiterate, commercialize quantum dot, quantum light sources. And right now, we have a very close relationship with NIST. We are working with CU as well. So we have, right now, quantum dot growth, nanofabrication, characterization, everything's happening at NIST. But with the university, we do have an amazing scientific advisor, Professor Shuo Sun, who joined Icarus at the very beginning. And we are doing a lot of collaborations with him in his lab as well. And his research is very much focused on quantum emitters, which is a more general term. So not only limited to quantum dots, but defect centers and diamond as well. But we are working with him to figure out ways to increase the efficiency of our devices. Yeah, so looking back, we started, the unique value proposition that we have is that we are doing it, making quantum dots and actually putting these types of quantum dots that we're making into something is a very, I wouldn't say risky business, but it needs a lot of iteration. There are many things that are not understood about these quantum dots. So I would say it's very much an art at this point until we figure out everything piece by piece. So the fact that we are doing everything here at NIST facilities and that we can, from the growth of the quantum dots to nanofabrication to characterization and then giving feedback to growth, that can take 3-4 days. So that is very important that we can do this and we can increase the quality of our devices just step by step. And that's what we've been doing since we started Icarus. Again, in a very close collaboration with NIST. NIST is not only funding us, but we have an official collaboration going on through other government contracts together as well. And so just, making the devices better and slowly growing the team at Icarus as well.
That's great. It sounds like it's almost like an auto-scaling machine, like you've got the power of NIST behind you with all of access to their labs and some of their resources and so on, I expect, right?
Yeah, it is. It is an amazing facility. Like looking at all the resources there are here of course, this is all happening as basic research, and that's why NIST is interested in moving forward with us. But quantum networking right now is pretty much still basic research.
Definitely.
But yeah, we are very grateful to NIST. It's been an amazing experience so far.
Have you got competition? Are there multiple organizations like you doing similar kind of things? Quantum networking, you've already alluded to some of the different sources and the different ways you need to move between different wavelengths or whatever it is you're doing with the quantum information. What does that look
Absolutely.
Like?
Absolutely. In the quantum dot space, there are a couple of amazing companies in Europe who are working on with the same platform, like Quandela, Sparrow Quantum, AGIC, and...
But in NIST, I mean, within the NIST organization.
Oh, I see. Within NIST, there is a very unique dynamic here that I haven't much seen in the higher up academic institutions, that the collaboration level here, it really trumps the competition. So everybody wants to collaborate with each other much more than, I want to beat this guy, this or that. So I don't know if that's what you meant by competition.
I guess
at NIST.
If they've selected you to be the quantum dot manufacturer and point of expertise within their ecosystem, or whether there's some competitive play. It's quite often these public sector bodies like to fund lots of the same thing to see which one can come to the top.
So in our case, it actually came about more organically. I would say that we were doing this research, and even though our group is a very large group, it's a group of 40 people. The people who are working on the quantum dot project, there's 5 of us, and so we decided that we should start and commercialize this. And so going about that, everybody's been like from the students all the way up to our group leaders and division chief, everybody's been very supportive about the efforts. And it's not so much that we were picked to be the only quantum dot manufacturer. It's just, we're the ones doing it right now.
Cool. Thank you. Yeah. It just grew out of the ecosystem then. The sounds of
yeah.
It. Yeah. Okay. Let's jump onto some technology, shall we? Could you give me a bit of a detailed walkthrough of what quantum dots are? Are there different types? What are the pros and cons of them? Which are the ones you use and why? And what are the idiosyncrasies of setting them up and managing them and hosting them on a platform of some kind? Give me a bit of a brain dump. I think that'd be great for our listeners as well to get that.
Yes, of course. Quantum dots are generally just nanometer sized particles that can show some type of quantum effects. And there are many different kinds of quantum dots that you can make by in very different ways. So you can actually make TVs out of quantum dots. You can make solar cells out of quantum dots. And you can also use them for quantum technologies as quantum light sources. So in our case, the way that our quantum dots are made by molecular beam epitaxy, which is you just grow this nanometer-sized island of one material on top of another one, just atomic layer by atomic layer. And whether it's due to strain, whether it's due to you've already made a hole in the other material and you're just filling it, these atoms are going to sit right next to each other in a crystalline lattice because the materials that we are growing are crystalline. So you can think of it as one crystal and we're growing another crystal right on top of it. And in the case of in one species of the quantum dots that we work with, this is the islands, the quantum dot is formed based on strain. So we are growing indium arsenide on top of gallium arsenide. And the crystal structure of these two are very much similar. It's just the lattice constant or the size of the crystal for one of them is slightly smaller than the other. And so it's not different enough that these crystals won't bond to each other. So it's when we're growing this other crystal on top of another one, it is still, they're bonding and they become one wafer. But because of this tiny difference between the crystal sizes, then there's going to be a strain induced on top of the other material. So it's going to pull it until an island is formed. And that's how we're making our quantum dots. And it is really important, if you want to use these for quantum technologies, that there are no defects around, that everything is as pure as you can make it. And that is why we're using molecular beam epitaxy and atomic layer by atomic layer growth of these quantum dots. Because even though these have thousands of atoms inside of them, we want to treat this quantum dot as one giant artificial atom. So we want it to have all the quantum properties that an atom in a very pristine condition that can, we want the quantum dot to show the pristine conditions of an atom. And that is why we call them artificial atoms.
Cool. Thank you. So first of all, I'm thinking you're growing a crystal. First of all, I imagine you with a watering can, maybe a hoe. But now it's atom by atom layer. It almost sounds like 3D printing. Is it a chemical reaction of some kind? Or is it how are you planting the individual atoms there? How does the process work?
Yeah, so the machine that we're using, which is a very expensive machine for this, it works at ultra high vacuum and the process is at high temperature, so 600 degrees Celsius. And the way that it works is your wafer sits in this chamber and then there are cells in this chamber, cells of just different materials. And we're just opening these cells and bombarding the surface with these different materials. And so they come and sit, and because, yeah, the crystals match more or less with each other, then they sit on the wafer and they bond to the wafer. Right. After they touch the wafer, they're part of it from then on.
Got it. Okay, cool. So you end up with these quantum dots. You're talking about them behaving as one atom. Is that a bit like a Bose-Einstein condensate in a way, where you have multiple gaseous atoms in a cloud which act like a, you know, you can perform individual quantum operations on a group of atoms? Is it the same in quantum dots? Am I understanding that correctly?
More or less. I don't know much about Bose-Einstein condensates, but from my limited knowledge, what I understand is that the main difference between quantum dots and a vapor cell is that this is a solid-state material.
Yeah.
Everything is in this crystal structure and all the atoms are sitting exactly where they're supposed to be sitting. Mm. So even though they're moving, they're vibrating, but the nice thing is you can cool them down and they stop vibrating. So in that sense, with Bose Einstein condensates, there are quantum properties that you can probe and use, but there are some things that are out of reach unless you trap individual atoms. Whereas with quantum dots, you can actually treat this as a trapped individual atom.
Got it. Okay. Thank you for the layman's response for me. Next question then is, why are you creating these quantum dots? You said they're photonic emitters. What's the use case?
So the way that we're using these quantum dots are as deterministic quantum light sources. And by quantum light, single photons, entangled photons, chain of photons that are entangled with each other in whatever ways that you want. And quantum dots can generate all of these, and in principle, deterministically. And what I mean by deterministic, first of all, let me explain how we're generating light from these quantum dots. So the way that happens is with an atom or with a quantum dot, there are different energy levels and they're quantized. So if you are exciting the quantum dot somehow, you can do that electrically, you can do that optically. In our cases, if you want the property of the quantum light that it emits to be as high that you can use it for quantum networking, then you have to excite them optically. What we do is we go zap a laser onto this quantum dot, and it goes from the ground state to the excited state. And it stays at the excited state for some time until it decays, until it goes back to the ground state and it emits a photon. And we can do this whole process deterministically. We can deterministically excite the quantum dot, and the quantum dot, every time that it emits, every time that it decays, it gives us a single photon. And so the process, the whole thing is deterministic. And so this is the way that quantum dots can generate single photons. And a lot of groups are using these as the best, the most efficient single photon sources. And they've been breaking the record for single photon efficiency year after year. What we're more interested in is to generate entangled photons deterministically with them. So instead of going one level up, we go two levels up. So let's think of this as exciting the quantum dot twice. So it goes, instead of going to the exciton state, it goes to the bi-exciton state. And then when it decays, it gives you two photons. But the cool thing is that two photons are entangled in polarization. So there are two different decay channels. They can both be horizontally polarized when they're emitted, or they can both be vertically polarized. And so that gives us an entangled photon pair. And this process can happen deterministically as well.
I'm going to ask you a whole bunch of questions now.
Yes, please do.
So first of all, photons, I believe when they're emitted from something which is changing energy levels, they can be emitted in any direction. Is that the case? And if so, how do you catch them? Do you have a little waveguide or something that you guide them into somehow?
Yeah, so that is, with most of the quantum emitters, the main challenge is, yes, how do you catch the photons that are emitted? Because, yeah, they can emit in all different directions. But the cool thing is, if you put optical cavities around the quantum emitters, it'll not only capture the light that is emitted in that particular direction that is in the quote-unquote cavity mode, but also it forces the quantum emitter to emit only into that cavity mode, depending on how good the cavity is. So if you have a cavity that is, and you can quantify how good a cavity is by its quality factor. And think of this as, if I'm putting an optical cavity as just two mirrors, and we're putting a quantum emitter right in the middle. And so how good a cavity is, just meaning how reflective the mirrors are. And if the mirrors are very reflective, then most of the light, and by most I mean more than 90, more than 95% of the light, can be emitted into only this cavity mode, even though if the cavity did not exist, the quantum dot could, or the quantum emitter could emit in all different directions. After the cavity is placed around the emitter, then it changes the properties of the emitter in a way that it will more probably emit in the cavity mode and in one direction as opposed to all the other directions.
The only analogy I can think of there is the wave function. Is the wave function of the emitter or the whole system affected when you introduce the cavity then, is that? Or am I just connecting two things which are totally different there?
I don't know if we can think about it that way, but you might. It is. So the way that I like to think about this is when you put the cavity around an emitter, then there's a number which is called Purcell factor. And the emission into that particular direction is enhanced by that Purcell factor. And when that Purcell factor is higher and higher, then yes, if you're looking at the emission of the emitter, that is changed by the cavity and it's influenced by this. So definitely if you're looking at the spatial wave function, or even in frequency or in time, it actually changes the wave function of the emitted photon. So it can make the quantum emitter to emit faster as well. So not only in one direction, but also faster. So the faster meaning, once you excite it, then the decay is just going to happen at a fraction of the time.
Okay. And do you always go down to two energy levels down to the ground state every time? Or does it not matter if it's already a level 50 or something? Or do you just not, I guess, how discrete is it? How specific is it in terms of energy levels?
With an atom, it is a rather easier, still a complicated question, but with an atom, it's easier to answer that if there are two levels, then you get excited, you excite this atom, it takes some time. So the excited state has a lifetime. And meaning after this lifetime, it is more probable than not for you to find the atom in the ground state after that. And so it's a probability game that after a long time, then if you're waiting for 10 lifetimes, then yeah, most probably you're going to find the atom in the ground state. For quantum dots, it's a little bit different because there's many energy levels. So that especially in a crystalline structure, because you have so many atoms, instead of just two levels, you actually have two bands, two energy bands, which is a result of atoms sitting together in a crystal. If you have all these atoms like in a vapor cell, then they have their individual energy levels and you can address them individually. But in the case of the quantum dot, you have this kind of collective energy level, which is now these two bands. So we call the ground band, let's say, we call that the valence band. And then there's another band above it, which is called conduction band. There are no allowable energies in between the valence band and conduction band. But once you go below the valence band, there are many energy levels that you can occupy. And once you go above the conduction band, there are many energy levels. So what we do by exciting the quantum dot, we're going to go match the energy of the laser that we're exciting it with to the difference between the energy, the valence and the conduction band. And so that way, if we were able to initialize the quantum dot at the top of the valence band, then it will jump to the only available option that is in the conduction band, which is the closest level up there. And that way, we know once it decays, it goes hopefully back to the ground state, to the ground state that we started from. And it does get more complicated than that because it can go to other ground states that you don't want. But there, a cavity can help too. So you can make a cavity that only resonates with the mote that you care about. So once a quantum dot emits, you know exactly which mode it emits at. And this is only one way of exciting them. You can actually excite the quantum dots from different ground states to different excited states. And there are different methods. It's just this is one particular method which has shown to give you the most, let's say, the purest and the most indistinguishable photons. And indistinguishability is really needed for quantum technologies, because if you have 10 photons that you want to interfere with each other, then you want all of them to have the exact same frequency, the exact same polarization, and so on. So if you're using this quantum dot 10 times, you want it to give you the exact same photons every single time, which is why we're using this scheme of excitation that I mentioned.
Fascinating, thank you. It's a complicated world pretty quickly, isn't it, in photonics?
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, I wish I could squiggle a little bit on the whiteboard behind me.
Yeah, yeah, go ahead, but it just wouldn't translate to the podcast very well.
Yes, no, I understand.
Got a couple of more topics following on from that. First of all, the rate of emission. The reason why I'm asking this is I was reading about other entanglement sources and the rate of emission that they're saying that they can provide. First of all, with a single quantum dot, what kind of rate do you get? And what rate are you targeting in an end product? Or maybe if you can't answer that, what kind of rate do you think is necessary for the use cases that your customers and NIST are looking for?
So with one quantum dot, even if it's not in a cavity, the rate that you can use it at, it just very much depends on its lifetime. And we're fortunate with quantum dots because this lifetime is not that long. So once you excite the quantum dot, it decays really fast, and by fast, and within a couple of nanoseconds. That dictates how fast you can use this quantum dot. You can re-excite it. And so in our case, we can actually use these at gigahertz levels. So we can potentially make billions of photons and generate billions of photons a second with only one quantum dot. And that is really in contrast with any other types of quantum emitters, which in my knowledge are orders of magnitude slower. And it is the rates game. When you get to real world applications of quantum networks, you want to have reasonable rates for whatever application. Once you distribute entanglement, you want to have enough photons to do whatever protocol that you want to do, whether it's generating encryption keys, whether it's connecting two quantum computers to each other. So quantum dots are really good in that way. And now you can only enhance this number by putting an optical cavity around them. And so what we're targeting is that not to go higher than 10 gigahertz, but something in that range is a very sweet of a spot that we can use for really high rate entanglement distribution over quantum networks.
So I'm an end-to-end systems guy. I can't help but thinking about how all the things are going to link together. When you've got a rate that's that quick, and it's okay if you haven't thought about this yet, because I know you're focusing on a very nuanced technology at this point in time. I guess with that rate of generation across a network, the timing and the synchronization between end nodes to be able to, first of all, index and then select a particular entangled pair of photons to interact with within a very small window, the determinism levels, and by that I mean the network determinism levels, go through the roof, don't they? They're extremely demanding. Have you thought about that at all?
So, actually, coming from an ultra-fast optics group, where I did my PhD, there are the level of precision that you can track fluctuations in optical fiber is much, much better than nanoseconds. And so that's not a big, at least right now, it's not the biggest hurdle that faces us. Nanosecond stabilization is state of the art, can do orders and orders of magnitude better. And it is like, even right now, the entanglement sources that are used in the quantum networking test beds around the world, they're based on probabilistic processes, but they're excited by these very narrow pulses, which are on the order of picosecond, if not shorter. And so picosecond is already three orders of magnitude shorter than nanosecond. And so for a quantum network, you probably will need something on the order of picosecond synchronization. And when I mentioned that you can actually get much, much better, femtosecond synchronization is also doable. And it's also something that I personally worked on, just looking at generating quantum states in different time bits. And yeah, that is something that people are working on for quantum networks as well. When the fibers get longer, it just gets more and more complicated. So there's a question of, as you get to hundreds of kilometers or even more range of optical fiber, with what precision you can stabilize them. But yeah, nanosecond seems to be fine.
Yeah, that's good. So maybe just my frame of reference or my level of expectation needs to adjust. And you just reminded me about the, of course, the Nobel Prize last year in physics for the attosecond science. Of course, I'm not sure whether that was relating. Yeah. Well, that was relating to optics, wasn't it? Quantum optics.
It was related to, that. I believe, yeah, generating pulses, attosecond pulses, light.
So nanosecond is slow, basically. That's how I need to think.
Exactly. Nanosecond can be really fast in some sense, but can be really slow in another sense. And we're fortunate that it is slow in the sense that we want it to be slow, and fast where we want it to be fast.
The determinism, then, I guess that's a very useful thing when you're sending that amount of entangled photons, because you know they're going to arrive within a particular window, basically. Each and every one is going to be reliably produced at a particular time compared to the one before it and the one after it. So I guess this is one of the main benefits, isn't it? That the other systems in the network can rely on that repeatability, that reliability of the determinism?
Yes, this having a deterministic process basically translates into efficiency. What is, when I push a button, what's the probability of me getting an entangled photon pair? And if that number is low, maybe I can wait. Maybe I can use this device a bunch of times to increase this efficiency. That's fine. But in quantum networks, when you bring in quantum repeaters and when you interface multiple of these sources to repeat the quantum information to go longer distances, then this efficiency becomes a much bigger problem, because now all of these sources have to fire together. And so you're not just having one source. And right now, the efficiency with these, with the probabilistic sources, the spontaneous parametric down conversion, there's a trade-off between entanglement fidelity and efficiency. So to have good entanglement fidelities, you can't go to efficiencies higher than 1%. And so it taps out. And so imagine if you have 10 of these sources that you want to interface with each other, and they all have to fire together. What is the probability of all of them firing together? It's 1% to the power of 10. So a very small number. And people have done it. It's amazing that people have done this, but it becomes unscalable, is the point. And in our case, the whole process is deterministic fundamentally. So then the question becomes, how efficiently can you do all the steps? How efficiently can you excite the quantum dot? Can you get the photons out into optical fiber and so on? But there's no fundamental ceiling to the efficiency, at least theoretically anymore. And that opens the door to actually scaling quantum networks to much longer distances. Now, this is not the only piece that a quantum repeater needs. You will need quantum memories for sure to ever increase the rate, but it is a very good first step. We will be able to interface many of these sources before needing a quantum memory. So maybe even going city scale to a city-scale quantum network.
Cool, thanks. So now I'm thinking about the user stations, the connected devices. It could be, let's stick with quantum computers for the time being, because we see this kind of collective direction towards distributed quantum computing.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned transducers at the beginning. Is that how you envisage the quantum dots being implemented, as a step in the path between transduction? I know I've said to others on previous interviews, it depends, of course, on the modality of the equipment and how it carries its quantum information. But I think that's how you described it at the beginning. But I'm just checking. Is it different? Yeah. Have you got different types of ways that the quantum dots implemented into the interface between the computer and the network?
Yeah, so there are a couple of different ways that we can go about this. One is, okay, what is a quantum network good for? And the first step of what a quantum network is good for is that if you distribute keys through a quantum network, through an entanglement-based quantum network, then it is not breakable, but by a large-scale quantum computer. In that sense, and based on all the progress that QuEra or IBM have had in the past few years, we know that it's coming. We know that a large-scale quantum computer is coming. Not in the next couple of years, but probably in the next 10 years. So we have to move to some type of quantum-resistant encryption, which one way is post-quantum cryptography, which is much easier to implement. It's, however, not provably secure. However, quantum networks are provably secure against quantum computers, just a different type of encryption than what we're using right now. With two lines of math, you can prove that a quantum computer or a classical computer, doesn't matter how big it is, it can't break this type of the type of encryption that is distributed over quantum networks. So security is the first application. And if we're looking at the security application of quantum networks, then we use our quantum dots as just quantum light sources. So not to connect quantum computers. This architecture does not need quantum computers to operate. It's just to distribute keys that are unbreakable by a quantum computer.
Sure.
So that would be in my opinion, it's more of a lower hanging fruit.
Well, that's the technology that's nearest commercialization, right? Where you're seeing more companies have a number of different universities and hubs around the world that have been focusing on this for the last 5 to 10 years. That's why we're at this point. So I would expect that. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So in that sense, our quantum dots will sit in nodes of generating entanglement, and then you distribute them. Of course, you will need single photon detectors. You will need quantum memories for this network to be operational. And that's pretty much it. Now, the holy grail of quantum networking is, however, connecting quantum computers to each other to exponentially enhancing their processing power, to do distributed quantum computing, to do the modular quantum computing, same way that you do processing with GPUs, right? And in that sense, right now, I don't think our quantum dots are to a level that they can compete with other platforms for quantum computing. But they can sit in transducers and they can convert the quantum information from light to superconducting qubits to even other platforms. There are companies that are working on quantum dots for quantum computing, and there's been a lot of excitement there. There are some types of quantum dots that are actually not optically active, but they're really good for interactions between one quantum dot to the other. And in that sense, there's been a lot of excitement in using those quantum dots for quantum computing. And there are a few startups who are actively working on that. And I believe Intel is working on that as well, but I could be wrong.
In silicon, right?
Yes, in silicon, that is the main one. In silicon, there are, I think, different platforms as well. I think they started in gallium arsenide. There are complications with gallium arsenide, with the quantum dots that are in gallium arsenide and using them for quantum computing. But I think that they've been addressed by moving to quantum dots in silicon.
Right. Yeah. Like a lot of these different modalities, there's all these pros and cons, right? And you really need to know your onions to know whether it's the right thing for you to try and implement or not. Mm-hmm. They're fixed. They may have a good lifetime, but they may have coherence issues. There's all kinds of different things going on, right? It's such a sensitive system every time. Yeah, so essentially, I the way I see it is that Icarus is focusing on entanglement distribution. That's really the, or sources, I should say, entanglement sources, which is deterministic. Mm-hmm. That's your sweet spot. So tell me, what about a bit of a roadmap? How far forward can you look? Is there anything that you're dreaming about on the horizon that you could share?
Yes. Right now, it's a small startup, so we're really focusing on just building this device. And we will be doing that in the next couple of years. The dream is to start building our own quantum network here in Colorado. There's a lot of excitement around quantum technologies in Colorado through the, we have this new entity here in the state, Elevate Quantum, that you mentioned in the beginning. So we're trying to figure out how to work with different entities to build a small quantum network, let's say, and figure out how to scale that to different cities or around the region. And building this quantum network of our own, I think that would be a milestone. And then using our devices to show the rates, to show that it's operable. And you can use this for different use cases. You can use this to connect data centers. You can connect banks to each other. And to bring quantum networks from the test beds and transforming them to the commercial side, that they actually bring value to people, that is something that we're hoping to move towards.
Is the ecosystem in Colorado complete in such a way that it, you know, I'm aware that Inflection is part of the group because of the location.
Yes.
But then what about a QKD vendor that uses entanglement? And what about a quantum computing company that could potentially use your entangled sources at some point? Have you got those types of partners in Elevate Quantum as well?
Yeah, so the amazing thing in Colorado and in Elevate is that we have literally all the pieces needed for any type of quantum technology to be implemented. To go through the pieces that you would need for a quantum network, there are companies that are working on quantum memories, on single photon detectors. Our group at NIST makes the most efficient single photon detectors in the world. And there's this amazing fiber infrastructure in Boulder and also in the region as well. Now, moving a little bit farther beyond quantum networking, there are these amazing quantum computing companies, which, Inflection, on top of all the other stuff that they're doing, they're also, very much focused on quantum computing. There's Inflection, there's Atom Computing that, just a few months ago announced a 1,000-qubit quantum computer. And there's Quantinuum here. So it is very seamless for us to go partner with these guys and, figure out the logistics to first build the quantum network, build a very preliminary quantum network, and then to scale that up. And at the end of the day, most of these technologies work at low temperatures. In our cases, quantum dots should be cooled down to about 4 Kelvin. So 4 Kelvin compared to some of the other platforms is very hot.
There were the mini Kelvin.
Yeah, superconducting. Superconducting qubits have to operate at millikelvin temperatures, so they need to lose their refrigerators. But there are a couple of companies that are making these fridges here, Colorado, like Mabel Quantum and Danaher as well. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. But so it has, we have everything from the bits and pieces and also the types of technologies that kind of go cross-discipline and like putting everything together. So we're really excited to grow the portfolio of equipment and in Colorado and bring everything together in a network, pun intended.
It also means you've got no excuses. You need to get on with it, Paul Adams.
And exactly.
get it done. Oh, it's good to have that runway. Yeah. It really is. Can we talk about customers a little bit? You mentioned public sector bodies, and on your website, you're showing free space links, maybe optical and satellite links, entanglement sources, going down to the ground. I know this is really bleeding edge stuff, but are you working on anything that kind of brings the space and quantum domains together?
Yeah, so we are working with the Department of Defense very closely. And one particular project that we have is to use our quantum dots for satellite-based quantum networking. And this is to, there are a lot of complications for the, like the first step is for free space quantum networking, you have to deal with all the noise, all the light that lives around. So you want to be in a very sweet spot with the bandwidth of your photons, and you want to be at a very specific wavelength, and you want to be able to travel for thousands of miles to get to the satellite. So we're trying to address these, and we think the deterministic nature of our entanglement sources can play a big role. And the fact that they magically work at this gigahertz rate, which is fast enough that you can distribute these high rates of entanglement. However, it's narrow enough that you can filter it in frequency and you can filter out all the noise and still be left with a very good signal with very low noise. We think that there's a good use case there. And so that is right now what we're pursuing with the Space Force down in New Mexico. We are, however, working to figure out how to use our sources for fiber networks as well. And yeah, we think that'll be the first step. We're not going to go to satellites first. We're going to use them in fiber networks. And so for that, we're working with NASA and Harvard University to make our sources suitable just for fiber optical networks. And what I mean by that is that the wavelength of the quantum dots is, at least the ones that we're using are not suitable, are not the telecom wavelength per se. And so we're working on doing frequency conversion from what we have to the telecom wavelength to do just low loss, to have the lowest losses when we go through optical fiber.
Yeah, I'm always fascinated by the satellite-based stuff just because it crosses two domains that I'm interested in, and it's a bit more futuristic. Mm-hmm. But realistically, we would have come back to the ground, haven't we? I mean,
so Colorado is a very big hub for space applications as well. There is a big Space Force base in Colorado Springs, and a lot of space companies around Ball Aerospace. And yeah, once we're definitely not ready to put our sources on a satellite, but once we are, then we have a bunch of amazing partners to reach out to here as well.
Ball Aerospace, they've just been acquired by British Aerospace, I believe, BAE as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's going to be interesting for BAE. But yeah, no, I heard anecdotally about a test of entanglement distribution from a satellite. I don't know if it was in China, but the anecdote was that they managed to achieve one coincidence count per second. The success rate that they achieved was one coincidence, if that's the right term.
One per second.
One per second, yeah.
That is heroic.
So if you're sending, what was it, the billions a second or something, yeah, then you've only got to get more than one through and receive it at both ends, and you've already beaten a record.
Yeah, that is the hope. Yeah, there was an experiment a couple of months ago between that with a satellite, they, I think, distributed entanglement between China and Russia, which was, yeah, very interesting. I don't know the details there.
I don't think much was shared.
Actually, yeah, I don't think much was shared, but
yeah, I'm not sure if that was the one or not, but hey, I'm looking forward to hearing the news about the one in the US that's going to come at some point.
Yeah, the government has noticed that we should move in that direction, and both NASA and Air Force or Space Force, they're all working towards it. very active.
Yeah, it's really the only way that long distance quantum communication is going to work at the moment, right? Long distance. But there's so many things which need the scheduling, the swapping of states, the classical part of it, the timing, let alone the stuff that's on the payload. Yeah, anyway, thanks for that little detour to my kind of fantasy world of satellite quantum. Thanks very much, Poulad. I'm going to wrap it up just by saying thank you very much, and thanks for answering my barrage of questions that I chucked at you. Thanks very much. And you know, the responses were brilliant, so appreciate it.
Of course. This is a pleasure, Dan. Yeah. Had a lot of fun.
Okay, bye for now.
Bye.
I'd like to take this moment to thank you for listening to the podcast. Quantum networking is such a broad domain, especially considering the breadth of quantum physics and quantum computing, all as an undercurrent, easily to get sucked into. So much is still in the research realm, which can make it really tough for a curious IT guy to know where to start. So hit subscribe or follow me on your podcast platform, and I'll do my best to bring you more prevalent topics in the world of quantum networking. Spread the word, it would really help us out.